Welcome everyone to the Philip Gilbert episode of Sigma Sports Presents Matt Stevens Unplugged. What can I tell you about Philippe? Well, he's one of the most decorated cyclists of the modern era, with 80 victories to his name. Now he's in his last season, running with Lotto Soudal, and he has some pretty interesting plans for his final ride before retirement. In fact, you could join him on the Cowberg. Keep listening to find out how. We chat about the differences between riders that turned pro 20 years ago and the ones turning pro nowadays, and he has some interesting observations there. He also has some very solid opinions on the optimal length of your socks and bib shorts in order to maximise the aesthetics of your muscles, or muscle. We've got a first for this podcast because we play Philippe your questions sent in via voice note, and he even answers them. Stay tuned to see if we chose your questions. And basically, if you did send them in, you did get them answered. There's a hometown quiz, of course, and Philippe even manages to invent his own game by slightly misinterpreting my question. But who am I to create an absolute legend? So, pop on your rainbow striped jersey if you're a former world champion. Stick your feet up on your cobblestone trophy if you've won Paris-Roubaix, and enjoy the Philippe Gilbert episode. I realise I've just described Philippe Gilbert, but you can enjoy it anyway, even if you're not him.
It's that time again, Matt Stevens Unplugged
Podcast. Stone Circle is back in June 2024. Forget your Glastonbury's and your Coachella's, this is the midsummer festival every gravel rider needs on their calendar. With three awesome routes, 55k, 155k and 220k's, there really is something for everyone. There's also a campsite with showers, hot food, cold beer, an optional fancy dress hill climb and lots of other fun stuff to make it the best weekend of 2024. Prices from £55, book Stone Circle today at hotchili.com and get a fiver off with the code PODCAST5. Hot Chili is spelled HOTCHILLLE and .com is spelled full stop COM. Philippe Gilbert is in the autumn of a career that has too many highlights to mention, although I'm going to mention a couple. He's a former world champion and a stage winner at all three Grand Tours, not bad for a classics rider who has also won four of the monuments. He's still really passionate about the sport and plans one final ride with his fans in October 2022. I was keen to learn more about that, his favourite victories, and of course how many words he could spell using the letters of his hometown of Remouchon whilst listening to a stressful 30-second countdown. Check it out. Philippe Gilbert, a legend of cycling. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on my podcast. How are you?
Hi, Matt. Thank you. I'm really good. Thank you.
And what we always like to do at the start of Matt Stevens Unplugged with our guests is for them to set the scene. So could you describe the room that you're in and also where in the world you are as well, please, Phil?
Right now I'm in Monaco in my living room, so on my table with a computer, the phone next to me, so I'm ready for you.
You're ready. I do believe you've got a drink of water as well.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
No other snacks or anything like that as
no.
Fuel?
No.
So there's no feed zone? There's no feed zone? No musettes?
No. It's just water.
Okay, mate. Good stuff. Well, Philippe, it's a pleasure to have you on. I'm a big admirer of yours over the years. I mean, there's so much to talk about. It's going to be difficult to know where to start, but I think the way we will start this is looking back over 20 years, we're coming towards the end of your last season as a pro. How are you feeling right now? And hopefully not too nervous being on the pod. You sound very relaxed, but how are you in yourself knowing that there's only a few months' time when you'll be finally hanging up your wheels?
Few races left and I'm feeling good about it because this is my own decision. And this was always important in my mind, you know, to choose the moment I will quit pro cycling, because during my career I met too many people that had to stop, really hoped to keep going but had no choice and had to stop, and then they sound like not happy or frustrated. And for myself, it's my own decision, so I'm really happy that I was able to make it, and I'm really looking forward now for the next chapter.
Yeah, you sound really quite relaxed and quite happy. And it's a really important point, isn't it? Making decisions on your own terms isn't something that everybody can do. However high up in whatever profession you're in, sometimes those decisions are taken away. But to maintain control is massively important. And Phil, just going back, I mean, at what point then, because you know you're 40 years of age, aside from Alejandro Valverde, you're one of the oldest riders in the peloton, most respected riders in the peloton. What point was it that you decided to say, okay, 2022 is going to be my final season? And when did you know in your head 100% that was going to be the right thing to do?
You know, when I had to resign a new contract, so it was with Lotto Soudal, I was looking for a 3 years deal, and they were first going for 2 years, and then after they offered me 3 years, and I was thinking, yeah, this is my last contract, because it will be 20 years. It's a nice number. It's a lot of sacrifice, a lot of kilometers on the bike, and it will be a good time to stop. So I was happy to get this contract signed, and obviously now with all the difficulties we had with the COVID, and so it was really quick. So actually, it passed so fast that we are already at the end of this contract, and it's time to stop. But I'm really happy to stop.
I mean, and your role in the team for the last 3 years, as you say, I remember in the press you agreeing to move from Quickstep, or to Koenig Quickstep, over to Lotto, a place where you'd spent already some happy years in your career. What's it like being the most senior rider in the team and riding in the same races as guys like Arnaud Delis, who is a sensation, but he is half your age. He's 21 years of age. Let's be really honest, Phil. You're old enough to be his dad. You know, this is the reality of our sport. You can ride for a long time. How's that been, that side of it, you know, being somebody that riders look up to? Have you enjoyed that slightly different role being in a team, somebody that inspires the younger riders?
Yeah, I was happy to sign in this team because, you know, it was not the highest level, and I was really trying to get it, you know, on the right way to work better, more professional. And it was not always easy, but I think I could give some tips to become a little bit better. It's still a lot of work to do, but I'm happy of what I did. And for me, this is something I like, to work as professional as possible. And I was trying to get, you know, the right mentality, right things in place. And I was investing a lot of my energy for that also, to make things change, you know.
And how did the team management deal with that? Because obviously that the management of the team is different to when you were with Lotto as well. They've undergone a few changes, haven't they? So was it the same sort of team, or did it have a really different feel to it, although it was essentially the same setup?
It's a different company, actually. So the team I was in stopped completely, and then they rebuilt a new team after that. And so this is the team of today. And I mean, like we said before, it's always possible to change more and do better. But it's already good what they did.
Yeah. And what about coming into this season in 2022, knowing it was your last one? Did you approach it like any other season in the past, or did you approach it in a different way? What was your mindset and also your training coming into the final season? What were your objectives, did it feel different for you, your last winter, you know?
I did everything, as best as possible, and I gave everything, but also not too much, because I had the experience, you know, to be next to Tom Boonen when he did his last winter. I remember, because Tom knew that he was stopping in Paris-Roubaix, he was giving everything, because, you know, he said, I have nothing to keep, you know, I don't need reserve for the rest of the season, you know, so I give it everything. And actually, I think he did too much. So I didn't want to do the same mistake. So I just did like what worked for me, and trying to do perfect. But then, the numbers on the watts and so were really good on training camp. And then I got sick, and then had a really hard time in the first 2 months, 3 months of the season. I was struggling with breathing problems, and that was pretty bad because I knew it was the last chance to do well in Sanremo and in other classics, and then it was like it was gone with this sickness, you know.
That's a shame. Yeah, and I know your strive for five was something that you'd been going for since you obviously won your last monument, Paris-Roubaix, in 2019. And it's a shame, but when you do look back, 80 wins. There's a nice symmetry, isn't there? 20 years in the pro peloton, 80 wins, countless wins, in monuments. But after Roubaix and Liège, clearly you got back into form because, it's you won the Quatre Jours de Dunkerque. You won a stage and won the overall. I would imagine that victory must have been particularly sweet for you to know that you can still operate at the top level. And it was only illness that was holding you back, because I know that I remember seeing it and thinking, wow, Phil still got it. I mean, how did that make you feel inside?
Yeah, I never gave up. I was really a long time sick. I never had this in my career, like so long. And I was getting better, and then it was another sickness coming, and I was never quit, So, but I was trying to get better, trying to start training again. So I restart training many times, and then it was sometimes hard mentally, because also in the racing it was not going like I wanted. So it was like frustrated. But I tried to finish still all my races, and this gave me like still a lot of training and fitness.
Yeah.
And the fact that I finished all the big classics, like even if I was not in front, I was like around position 50. So it means that you still go quite fast, even in the final. And this gave me like, the power to become better and stronger. And that's why I was good then in Dunkerque, because the week before Dunkerque, the climate changed, and because it was a really cold first part of the year. Really, really cold everywhere. Even here in Monaco, the air was really fresh and cold and dry. And then the week before Dunkerque, the wind changed, the climate changed, and it was warmer. For the first time, we reached the 25 degrees. And for my breathing problems, it was the end. I think I was just needed some warm temperature.
Yeah.
And then I was much better, and I was able to breathe again. And the form came back really quick.
And what was it like for you winning? I mean, obviously, when you look back at your results, the 4 days of Dunkerque is not the biggest race, but it's a really nice race to have won. I mean, do you think that is one of your most important victories? Because, unless you've only got a few more races left, you still could win some bike races, but I guess it must be quite a significant win in all of your career.
Yeah, it was nice because also the first day, we had Arnaud Delis there, and he was going to go for the win in the sprint. And I was pulling, because I said, guys, I just need to ride. I need some effort. So let me pull in front of the race, and this will open my engine for the next days. And so I was pulling like 150Ks, and I was feeling better at the end of the stage. I was feeling strong. And this gave me also confidence for the next days. And then, the crash happened with Delis. He had to quit the race. And then it was clear that I had also a chance, And the next day was a nice sprint uphill, like I like. And and I won the stage. So it was really nice. And I think it was nice that I could also show to the team that now that Delis was not there anymore, I could replace him. So it was a good sign.
That's cool. I mean, just looking back over the last couple of years in particular, all of the pros that I've had on my podcast recently, I think it interests me how cycling, obviously over 20 years since you've been riding, cycling, professional cycling has changed enormously.
Yeah.
But in the last couple of years, since COVID, since we started the season late in 2020, for me as a fan, as a commentator, being at the races and watching the races unfurl, there seems to have been this enormous shift and change in the way races are far more aggressive, far more unpredictable, far more chaotic. What has been your view as one of the most mature riders in the peloton and seeing this change in racing, the landscape, these young guys coming in, you know, creating chaos, also entertaining us? But what has it been your perspective, Phil? Because it's been, let's be honest, it's been pretty crazy, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's a big, big difference. I mean, for me, my explanation is that, you know, when I was turning pro, it was like 1 to 2, you know, neo pro turning pro every year by team.
Yeah.
So let's say it was like between 20 and 40 new riders every year. And then, you know, we had to race with the old guys, experienced guys. And then when you came in, you know, like it's normal, you're nervous, everything is new. You want to make your place into this new world. You want to show that, you know, that you turn pro is not for nothing. You want to make results. You want to be in front of the camera, you know, you want to be everywhere. So when you're like this, you know, it's up to the old guys to calm you, like in normal life, you know. Yeah. And back then, you know, when you did that, you did some shit, you know, like they will smash you or get you off the road. And then the next day you say, okay, I better stay calm. But today it's like you have 60 or even more turning pro, you know. And as an old guy or older guy with the experience, if you want to do what they did in the past, then it means that you will have to spend all your time doing this, you know, because it's too many of these young guys, you know, to teach them how to act in the peloton, you know, not throwing bottles everywhere, not going from left to right without giving a sign.
Sure.
Not braking like an idiot in the middle of the bunch, you know, not riding with one hand in the underbar, like so many things to do right that they don't do right anymore. But yeah, if you want to make the police inside the bunch, then it's like, yeah, you're also lost, you know, because you have to focus on your own effort also, you know. So exactly. Yeah, now no one say much and it's chaos because it's anarchic, you know.
Yeah, it's a really good way of putting it. I mean, I think from a spectator's point of view, it's quite entertaining. But from somebody who has been in the peloton a while, this isn't just something that's happened gradually. It seems to have accelerated over the last couple of years. So it's a really interesting point. You know,
like in the past, for example, you know, when it was an obstacle on the road, like a hole or a pole, we will point it and say to the guy behind you, watch out, there's something danger coming. Now the guys, they just ride like 2 centimeters away and then move on the last moment. So you're like touching the danger and then you can crash because of that, you know. So a lot of times they don't point the dangers and then, you know, a big crash happened, you know.
Yeah, it's as I say, it's certainly good from a spectator's point of view or entertaining, but it must be exceptionally chaotic. But and this is just might seem like a strange question, but you look at your 20 years in the peloton, the changes in racing technology. I'm a little bit older than you, but I've noticed you used to have really really good length of socks, Phil. And what is your view? Okay, I come out with a serious question sometimes. What is your view on the super long socks? Because you seem to be a man that's holding on to the past a little bit, still accepting that socks are longer. What are your thoughts on the ridiculous length of socks in nowadays?
I love short socks. Yeah, I love them, but I cannot find them anymore because they don't produce them. I have the medium ones, but like so many riders just ride with the really high ones. And it's the problem is like these guys, they really believe that aero is everything. I know it means a lot, but
of course,
I don't think that this makes you going so much faster, you know. Knowing that maybe 80% of the time you're just sitting in the wheels. So aero is not doing much at this time. So I can understand for a TT, you're by yourself and it's short and it's like every second counts. But on a road race, I don't think that this could make the difference. And Yeah, sometimes it's a shame when you have nice muscles, nice legs, to then show them to the people, you know?
No, no, exactly. Because let's be honest, pro cycling is has a beautiful aesthetic, that the fashion, the bikes, exactly, the suntan, the musculature of the riders. And back in the, when you look at some of your early wins, I mean, also the length of, while we're sticking on fabric and on the fashion side, the shorts are getting so long. So, yeah. I mean, I don't, but now I've got no suntan, Phil. I've got like all, the only thing of a suntan is my knee and half of my calf. And when I wear normal shorts, I'm like, I look like an idiot.
So I understand.
Yeah, crazy short lengths. Okay, so anyway, but yeah, I do like the pictures sort of back in 2002, 2008, that sort of era.
Yeah.
Where I think it, like you got, like you, Tom Bonin, the short length was permanent. So you can see ankles and thighs, you know?
Exactly. I remember watching all the magazines with the pictures, and I was watching all the pictures of these guys, you know, with, you could see the muscles, and it was so nice. And I will spend more time watching the muscles of the guys and the text, you know. So, I think it was part of the history and the aesthetic of the sport, yeah?
Oh, totally. Totally. Now, over the last few years, what element of the sport have you had to work the hardest on? I mean, to keep yourself in the frame? I'd imagine that your training has changed immensely over the last few years, that the access we have to information, all of the data, how has your training shifted? And have you found any of the new innovations particularly helpful to keep you strong and at the forefront?
Yeah, I start really working more specific when I turned to BMC 2012. Then I start using the parameters, and it really helps you because you control your training really precisely, and it's much easier. But at the same time, sometimes mentally it's hard, you know, to always follow a schedule, you know, because it's not like some other sport when you are in a stadium with your trainer next to you, with your teammates or the training partners. Cycling is like, you know, we just live where we live and we go training around the house. So it's like you need a big discipline to follow all these trainings. And sometimes it takes a lot mentally, you know, because you have an hour 45 or 2 hours of really specific trainings, you know, high intensity and things like that, you know. And when it's like hard, heavy sessions, you know, it takes a lot mentally.
Sure. And have you, I mean, just in relation to all the new technology now, I was chatting to another pro a couple of days ago. Do you think we're at the point where there's almost too much information for a rider to sort through and process, and that sometimes that the racecraft is left behind? Or is that just an illusion? What do you think? Do you think all this information is good? Do you think there's too much? What are your thoughts on it now? Because we are really on the cutting edge, aren't we? I mean, riders are going faster for longer.
Yeah.
Some of the watts per kilo that we're seeing some of these younger guys put out is insane. But there's so much information around. What do you think of that?
I think it's like it's innovation. It's like every sport is becoming more pro, and cycling is also following the things, you know. So it's also becoming more serious, more precise, and this is part of development. But yeah, how can you not use this, you know, when you know it exists? It's also financial incomes, you know, like, because some of the I don't know, like Garmin's or SRM, they are big sponsors for some teams, so it's important to have them there. So it's hard to say now we don't use this anymore, you know. So I don't know how we could not use them, because it's like some riders, they start riding in the juniors already with power meters, you know. So if you'd say to them now, you go racing without, first you have to put in place a system to control that no one use it. So I think it's quite impossible to make happen. And yeah, and then secondly, the guys would be lost. But then you will come back like in the past, you know, when you go on feeding, and then you when you go on feeding, sometimes you go wrong and you explode like we saw, and it was also nice, you know. But now it's clear that it's like, you know, on the climb, you know, if you did a test, a 20-minute test the week before, you know exactly when we are, where we are. And then, you know, I don't know, for this climb, okay, I can go 420 watts for 30 minutes. So I go this pace, and on top, I will be maximum 30 seconds behind the first one. So I come back in descent. So it's, everything is more calculated, you know?
Sure.
So that's why we don't see so much riders cracking anymore, because, you know, they just follow their own engine and own capacities. Yeah. And in the past, you know, we were just going like trying to follow the best, even if it was not possible, but we tried and then we explode and then, you know.
That's right. I mean, you are so right. When you look at obviously this year's Tour de France as an example, there was some really exciting attacking, but a lot of when you hear the riders talk, it's just, yeah, I rode to my pace. I did my own thing. And you hear this more and more, but but you and have to
know,
really, yeah.
And they know exactly they're going to finish fifth or sixth or seventh in the tour. They know they cannot do more, and they know they cannot do less, you know? So actually now when you know that you're not going to crash and you're not going to be sick, you know exactly where you're going to finish in the tour.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. I was chatting to Jay Vine, the young Australian lad from Alpecin de Koenig, who won two stages. I was speaking to him the other day, and I said, are you amazed at your win? He said, well, I am really pleased and a little bit surprised. But he said, once I knew that I had a certain amount, I knew I could sustain this power to the end.
Yeah.
And I knew that if I had a certain gap at halfway, even Remco had to go far over his capacity just to close the gap. So it's reduced to... It's still exciting, but it's reduced to mathematics and science, isn't it? You know,
exactly.
It's very interesting, but the confidence in those numbers means that if you, like I say, as long as you've got good shape, you've fed well, you're not injured on a normal day, you can ride to this capacity. It gives you a certain confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I also won a stage in the Giro in 15 like that. It was also a 10K climb. Normally, I will not, you know, play the win on this stage, but because of the, or thanks to, depends how you see, thanks to the power meter, I made it, you know, because I went on my own pace, and on top I was like, I don't know, 30 seconds behind. And then on last K, I said, now I go over my limit. I passed them, I attack, and I went alone, you know?
Sure.
So yeah, this is much easier.
Yeah. So with that in mind, because I find it, I think it's fascinating, you know, that the way we have to, and I was chatting to a few of the directeurs sportifs at the Tour de France, and with exactly what you said in mind, with everybody, all the domestiques, everybody knows their capacity. Even the sprinters know their capacity to finish in the time limit. Yeah. They know what they have to do. It's the same. And I was chatting to Mark Cavendish, and he said, I have to ride at 320 watts over every climb. Then know I'll finish inside the time limit. It's like, this is the sort of, everybody knows their limitations. So within that, how do you win bike races? I think, or beat your rivals, it becomes more, I think what it provides is an opportunity to be really creative and innovative with tactics.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like Jumbo-Visma in the Tour, isolating Roglic. And then it was just brilliant to see. I know you were racing it. You probably didn't see it. You were in the bunch. But do you know what I mean? I think the tactical brain now becomes even more important, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then also you see that, you come back to the money, you know, because it's like only the biggest team who can pay the best riders can win, you know. So, you need so much good riders in the final to make the difference that, you come back to the money, you know. So it's like, it's also not easy for the smaller teams, you know, to compete on the highest level because, you know, when you're a smaller team, you're like one or two guys surviving in the final. And then it's hard to get to beat like the five Jumbo guys, the five Quickstep guys, the three or four Alpecin, you know. So, it's not easy. Yeah. It's not easy to compete.
Yeah. Yeah, it's yeah, you have to think even smarter. And I think one of the things, I mean, not that I would ever compare my career with yours, Phil, but when I did race and when I was strong as a youngster, and now I look back, I'm 52 and I look back at what I could have done if I was smart. And now watching a lot of bike races, I'm learning more and more about the sport, even if through just commentating, and I find it fascinating. So I guess, I mean, you've always been a very smart rider. You know what engine you've got. You know the terrain that suits you. Even your rivals know. People say, don't they? They go to a bike race, and we say even now, oh, this is a Philippe Gilbert finish. It's just a thing that people say, you know, which I love. I mean, that must be a very cool thing. But yeah, it's just, I forgot what my point was now, but no, it's just that the whole tactical side of it, I find enormously fascinating. I really, really do. Now, Phil, we've already been chatting for half an hour, and I think we should, before we look back at your career, I think we need to look a little bit forwards, okay?
Yeah.
To a couple of things that are happening. Now, your last ride is a, for want of a better word, it's a celebration, isn't it, on the Cowberg. So do you want to explain to me and to people what it is and how they can get involved? And also, at the end of that, we're going to just talk a little bit about a competition we can have to win some tickets to. So what is Phil's last ride? It sounds a little bit ominous, doesn't it? but explain what it is.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, to decide the end of my career, like I said before. So that was the first point. And then I was thinking, and speaking to my managers, I said, look, guys, if all this happened, this is because of the collaboration of so many people. And I will not quit cycling without, you know, building an event to thank everyone and to see the last time everyone as a pro cyclist, you know, because, you know, I worked with the guys of Francis Desjeux many years ago, with the other Lotto team many years ago with BMC. And then, you know, you see them quickly every time on the race, but you never really speak to them anymore.
Sure.
And this is the way of having everyone next to me, you know, the people I love and the people I work to, and I'm thankful to them. So that's why we do this. First, also in the morning, it will be like a ride open to everyone. So all the fans are welcome for a 70, 75 kilometer ride on the Amstel course, which I won 4 times. So this was also important for me. And then we have we launched my book. Then I will be really, really close to the people to sign all kind of things. And then, you know, in the evening, it's more a private, you know, dinner with all the people I work with. And there will be, I think, an emotional moment because we will remember all the nice wins or defeat, everything, you know, like all we achieved together. And I will have all the managers I work with me that day. So that was also an important point. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to have my own event, you know.
And it's nice that people can come along and share as well. And what a great course to have it on. And not only the Cowberg, not only the
location. Yeah, and then also we have the criterium with the ex-teammates, you know.
Brilliant.
It will be an hour race with a few times the Cowberg. So yeah.
I know Tor and Alessandro Balan, two teammates of yours, are going to be riding. And I've seen Alessandro Balan in particular at the Giro every year. He still looks really fit. So be careful, because I think Balan could spring a surprise.
Yeah, he's not explosive enough for me.
Okay. Well, and that is on the 15th of October, yeah?
Yeah, in Valkenburg, so Netherlands.
Fantastic. And what we're going to do, so when this podcast goes out, well, you'll be listening to it now, if you check out Phil's social media on Instagram and my social media, there's going to be a competition where the prizes are 4 tickets to go to the Sportif, to Phil's last ride. So make sure you not only listen to this pod, which you'll be doing anyway, but check out at Real Stevens. And Philippe, what's your Instagram?
I think it's just Philippe Gilbert official.
There we go, Philippe Gilbert official. So we'll put that in the description as well. And also, so you touched on there a book. So what's obviously the book's looking back at your career, Phil.
Yeah,
what's it called?
It's a book with a lot of pictures, 180.
Oh, right, okay.
mainly about the wins I had, you know. So yeah, we tried to find all the pictures, you know. Some of the my wins were like not even in the media back then, or not much. So we found the nice pictures, and they will be edited for the first time. So yeah, and then of course a lot of text explaining how I won, why I was there, why I was informed there, why I was not informed. You know, like explaining a little bit my career, and it'll be, I think, a nice book because I spent a lot of time on it. So yeah, I'm really happy to also close my career with a nice book with memories.
Fantastic. I would imagine for you going back through those pictures and recalling all of the memories, because the races that you've won, I mean, it's only Jan Raas who's exceeded the single day wins, and the quality of your single day wins. There's riders that have won more races, but the quality of your wins is incredible. So I guess looking back and recounting them and getting them committed to text and writing them down must have been quite powerful in recalling, because I would imagine, Phil, that you've got a pretty good memory. Do you remember a lot of detail about your races?
Yeah, I remember actually a lot of details about all my career, not only the wins, you know, but also like the travels, the training camps, everything. I have a really good memories of it. And it was nice to put this on the text, you know, and then it's also nice for later, for the other generations. So I think it's important that to use your mind when it's still clear. So yeah, it will be a nice tool for later, for the young kids or for the future generation. So yeah, I'm really happy that I did this now.
There's a website for your Phil's Ride. So I've got the website up now. So if anybody wants to head there and register, it is www.philslastride.com. Simple as that, mate, isn't it? So philslastride.com, head on there. And there's some information about how to event. It's pretty straightforward as well. So yeah, head over there, and I'm sure Phil would love to see you and celebrate in his retirement. Hot Chili's London to Paris Gravel Adventure is a breathtaking 3-day ride that will stay with you forever. Trundle down towpaths, cruise across farm tracks, meander through woodlands, and take in the scenery on a route that's almost entirely off-road all the way from the Thames to the Seine. In fact, the route into Paris was designed by Sofiane Sahely, the king of French gravel, so you can be confident it's the best possible off-road route to the Eiffel Tower. The Hot Chili Ride captains will be there to show you the way, whilst the experienced event crew look after everything else so you can relax and truly enjoy the adventure. Treat yourself to a well-earned massage at lunch or at the end of each day, then relax over dinner and get a good night's kip at 3-star and 4-star hotels. Make September 2024 the highlight of your calendar and head to hotchili.com to find out more about the Hot Chili difference. Psst, podcast listeners can get 50 quid off entry. Just use the code PODCAST50 at the checkout, but don't tell anyone that doesn't listen to the podcast, okay? Now, Phil, we're about halfway through the podcast. Now, it's at this point that we're going to have a little bit of a quiz. I know you're prepared. I did give you a little bit of a warning because the quiz this. It's the Remouchon quiz.
Okay.
Yo, yo. What's up? Y'all ready? Let's do it.
Turn off your phone.
That's right.
Get your thinking cap on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's time.
What time?
Time for the
Remouchamps quiz. Or is it Remouchon quiz?
So, big shout out to Niall, our producer, who loves doing all these jingles. The pronunciation, I guess, Phil, is Remouchon.
Remouchon, exactly.
Okay, which is a little province in Wallonia. You're of course a Walloon, and it's just in Aouaiers. So Remouchon is a little tiny little village, isn't it? And then you're Aouaiers, that is the kind of more of the bigger town, I guess, next door, is it? So I'm going to be honest with you, Phil. I've done a lot of research here, but it's really hard because it's only a small part of Wallonia. It's been difficult to find some questions, but I have. Okay. So it's a multiple choice quiz. So you have four choices for each answer. The final question, you'll need your pen and paper, which I know you've got beside you. So are you comfortable? Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Let's do this. Okay. Right, question number one, Phil. What is the name of the underground river in the caves of Rémouchon.
Rubicon.
Okay. It is. I was going to say it's the Rémouchon's River, the Cathedral Noir, which I made up, or the Terminus. It's the Rubicon. Wow. Yeah. I'm going to give you an extra bonus for not even needing the multiple choice. So that's 2 points. So you're off to a flying start. The analogy for a bike race, Phil, you're in the early break. You're up the road. You know what I mean? Right. So good start from Philippe Gilbert. Clearly in good form. This one might be a bit more troublesome, but you don't know. Right. Question two. The crest or the coat of arms of Aoi. Do you know what I mean? The coat of arms, the shield.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So yeah. Each town and city has a little kind of coat of arms on the town hall, that sort of stuff. So Aoi has its own one. Okay. And I'm going to describe four different descriptions of what's on the crest. You have to give me the correct one. So, okay. The crest on the coat of arms contains either, is it A, it's a saint with a shield and two lions wearing crowns. That's A. Is it a lion with a crown and a shield with two saints? Or is it C, a river with a bridge and a shield with two lions? Or finally D, a river with a bridge and a shield with two saints? So, I don't know if you know it.
I would say D.
You're going to a river with a bridge and a shield with two saints.
Yeah.
It's the incorrect answer. I made that one up. It is. So next time you need to tell anybody, maybe put it in your next book after this.
Yeah.
When you talk about this podcast, it's a saint with a shield and two lions wearing crowns. Okay. Very, very particular. Right. So this next question, but you've still got 50% Phil, because you got 2 points for the first question. So you're still in a good place. Okay. Don't worry. Question three. The caves of Rémouchon, we're going back to the caves again, were previously used to store what? And it's before World War II. And in World War II, the caves were used as an air raid shelter. But before World War II, what were the caves of Rémouchon used for? Was it A, storing cheese, B, storing wine, C, storing cured meat, dried meats, or D, for storing jars of pickled vegetables?
Cool.
Yeah.
So was it cheese? What A again?
Cheese?
Yeah, no, I would say no.
Wine? Cured meat or pickled vegetables in jars?
I would say D.
It's not D, it's wine. No. It was an wine. Enormous wine cellar, yeah. Enormous wine cellar.
I didn't know that.
Okay, right. Question number four, you can redeem yourself. You've still got a reasonably good score. Did a quiz the other day with a gentleman who shall remain nameless, rides for Bahrain Victorious. He got zero. Okay. Anyway, so you're still in a good place. But the final questions, you'll need your pen and paper here. Okay, yeah. Phil. Now, the rules of this one is, so Rémouchon, if you write down the word Rémouchon, okay, I need you in 30 seconds to find as many words as you can in French or in English. Okay. Now my wife, who's very good at words, found 11 English words in 30 seconds. Okay.
With the letters of Rémouchon.
Yeah, exactly. So Rémouchon, just find as many words, English words as you can, or French words. So, because obviously you speak both.
But starting with the letters.
Oh. Yeah. Just so you could have, for example, Rome, R-O-M-E. So any of the letters, but you can only use them however many times they appear in the word. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we're going to have a countdown. So tell me when you're ready.
Okay.
And you'll get a point for everyone that you get correct. So I do believe Niall has a clock. So I'm going to count down. So 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay.
That's a very good clock. This is Philippe Gilbert, world champion, winner of all four monuments. This is the biggest test of his life so far. It is, how many words can he get from Rémouchon? We're coming towards the end now. I don't know how many he's written down. Very much, very near the end now. Two, one, and go. That was a great countdown. That was really dramatic. Okay, Phil. This is just a bit of fun. How many have you got, mate?
I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Oh, 6. Okay, what are the words?
So with the R, I put a river.
Okay, yeah.
River. E, I put a emotion.
Okay.
M, a monument. I was trying also to think about cycling, you know. The C of cycling.
Okay.
A of ambience. And a P of price.
Okay, well, that, I think we're going to give you we're going to give you the 6 points there. That's very well done, mate. Very well done. So, can we have a round of applause from our studio audience? I think you may have also inadvertently created another game out of two games. I think you've done exceptionally well there, mate. So, let's tot up the points. So, you've actually got 8 points. So, 2 at the start and 6 at the end. That's 8 points, which is an exceptionally high score. Well done, Phil.
Thank you.
Hold on. Okay. Actually, that works out as a 200% score in the quiz. So that's really good. Now, at this point, we're going to take a very, very short break in the podcast. Very, very short, because we've got a new section that we talked about. So we're going to take a short break and tee that up now. Well, we've got a brand new section of the podcast. So, again, we're using Philippe Gilbert as an experimental guinea pig, really, mate. Apologies for that, but hopefully this will be a bit of fun. Basically, we've opened up our phone lines, or our phone line at Sigma Sports, for voice notes, for people to get in contact and ask questions. So we've got a few questions that we're going to play. So let's listen to them now.
Do you believe that Lotto Sedal's situation in regards to the relegation system has negatively impacted your ability to choose the way you wanted your last season to go?
I believe that was from Benji Narsson, that one. So that's quite an interesting question, yeah, Phil. So what do you think?
Yeah, of course, I was pushing to race more, you know, because of the chase of the points. So, yeah, I had to race more than I expected, yeah.
And do you think, just off the back of that, do you think, and it's a controversial subject, but I think, you know, you're a vocal rider with all the experience that you've had. Do you think the relegation system is a fair one?
Yeah, because it's no, yeah, I think it's a lot of pressure, but it's a good way to give the chance of the smaller team to become, yeah, on the highest level, you know. But yeah, this team, so also need then the financial support and the professional abilities to be on the world tour. So yeah, you can have a lot of discussion about it. Yeah.
Okay. So let's have the next question.
Hi, Dan here. Just wanted to ask Philippe, now his career is winding down as a pro bike rider, what does he want to be remembered for? And if there was one bike race he'd be remembered for, which one would that be? Thank you.
That was from Dan, a very nervous Dan there. Thank you for getting in contact, Dan. So what do you think of that, Phil?
I would like to be remembered as a, you know, classic rider, like the one day races, someone who always attack, you know, not scared of going to the attack, make the race interesting. So yeah, I think that I gave a lot of spectacle to the fans in the last years.
I think the one thing's for certain that you have left a mark, not just because of the victories, but the manner of your victories as well, the style, the panache, that you have, you know. And I think that's, victories are one thing, but the manner of victories are very special. And I think within the cycling community, I think it's fair to say that the true fans, you know, they look at victories, of course, but it's the manner of the victories that's massively important, isn't it, as well?
Yeah. I think it's, for me, it was really important to win in a certain way, you know. I won some burn sprints, not many, but yeah, for me, these wins don't look so nice for me, because yeah, the burn sprints doesn't mean so much in my eyes. But when you go for a 50K solo in Flanders, this is like something that I'm really proud about it, you know.
This is where the romance of the sport comes in as well, yeah. Isn't it? I love it. I love it. I totally. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful answer. And I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, Matt. Phil Jill, 5-star Phil. It's Gary Skinner from Hertfordshire. I just wondered what it's like to ride, I imagine painful, on a broken knee. How did you do it? Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. That's a good yeah. question. I mean, we all remember that from a few years ago. Yes. So how did you do that?
Oh, I think I didn't know first that I had such a bad injury. So I just keep riding that day. And I was like so motivated. And I was still believing that I could restart the next day because I was thinking it was only muscle sore, you know, not. I really didn't expect that there was a bone broken, you know.
Sure.
So I keep riding and I was hoping, you know, I will have 2-3 hard days in the next days and then I will come back. The tour is still long and I will still fight for a win, you know, before the end of the tour. And then, you know, when I had to pass the medical test and the scan and things like that, we saw that I had a fracture and then it was over. So yeah, I only realized this after the finish, you know. So I went really deep in the pain that day. I think the deepest in my career, because I was really in pain for the last 60Ks. And now I know why I had so much pain, you know, because
yeah, of course,
in the moment itself, I didn't know that. And if I would knew it, for sure I would not go any further. But yeah, this show also the character, you know. I'm really hard in my head. And when I have something in my head, I never give up, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what is one of the most important things. And we're talking about it more and more, aren't we? It's a great question, that was. But more and more about the importance, obviously, of being fit, but even if you're the fittest, the strongest rider who can push the most power, if you don't have the mental strength, it's useless. You have to be mentally very, very strong. And I think cycling is the hardest sport there is. You go through so many different emotions, but pain is something that becomes something quite normal, isn't it? But I think often when a rider crashes, it's incredible how strong you can be. You've got the adrenaline as well, the emotion. It is quite incredible how strong you can become to overcome pain, isn't it?
Yeah, but that day was like still 60K, you know? So when you speak about adrenaline, this is normally like 2, 3, 4 minutes maximum, and then it goes off and then the pain is there and then our emotions come back. So 60K, it took me, because it was still a lot of climbs, so it took me a long time, and I really had time to suffer and had to think, you know, and cry on the bike. And yeah, I did everything that day, you know. I was like really deep in the pain, and the only good moment was like when I heard like I was 10Ks to go or something like that. I heard that Julien won the stage. And this gave me some joy again for a few seconds, and then the pain came back. And then, yeah, I received also the award on the finish, the most combative rider,
okay,
of the day. And that day, I think this trophy is in my kitchen in Belgium, because this one means a lot for me. You know, it's only a combative prize; it's not a trophy for a win, but. This one means so much for me that is good in place in my house.
That says a lot. It's a symbol recognizing your fortitude, isn't it? It's symbolic of the type of rider that you are, I think.
Yeah, exactly. This one, yeah. If I lost this one, I would be really sad. So it's a prize will have a really big importance in for me.
Okay. Well, from the combativity on that year's tour to back to 2012 to the World Championships, I don't think we could do this podcast without talking about that. I think what we'd need, Phil, to do justice to your career is have a series of 10 or 15 podcasts, but we haven't got time for that. But can you talk to me about the day of the World Championships, you know, going into that race? Obviously on the course, it was a course where already at that point, 2010, 2011, you'd already won 2 editions of Amstel. You were going to win 2 more editions afterwards, but you could argue the condition that you had, the course it was. It was a course tailor-made for Philippe Gilbert. So yeah, the pressure was even more so. People knew that you were going to go. So just talk to me about the lead into that race, how you were, and then finally how you went away on the cowboy to take that magnificent win.
Yeah, I think we have to go back to the beginning of the season when I I signed for BMC. I was struggling. I was not good. I was third in Flèche Wallonne and some result, but not that good, you know, in the classics. And then struggling again in the Tour, like top five in the stages, but not more. And then, you know, I was frustrated because, you know, I was paying really good by the team, expecting they had a big expectation out of me, and then I could not give what I wanted. So I was training, doing all the best, and then it didn't come. And then, like you see at this point, that the work always pay off, because I was after the Tour still racing and training like January, you know, same mentality. Like even sure, if I was tired of the season, I was giving everything. And I went to the Vuelta and there I won two stages. So then I was really happy that I showed that I was back to my level, winning two stages, you know, like we said before. So in a good way, not only winning, but like winning well, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was really important for me. And then, you know, I focused really good for the TTT, the World Championship also. I was part of the team and I was one of the best guys. The week after the Vuelta, we went straight away to training camp and I was one of the best. And then the day of the race, I gave really good show. And then we finished second for only a few seconds to Quickstep.
Yeah, 3 seconds, wasn't it? Just 3 seconds. Yeah,
3.2 exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I was sad again because, you know, I wanted to win there and again be part of the World Championship title. And yeah, being second was again frustrated. And then this gave me actually the extra motivation to even rest more, train more the week before the world title on the road. And that day I was really going with mentality to win. You know, I was quite confident of my chance and we raced really good as a team because we had Bonen and me and it was clear, the tactic was clear. So if it was a sprint, which I knew it was impossible, we will go for Tom. And if not, I will attack and go for myself. So
yeah,
when we came into the last descent, I had Leukemans next to me and I knew that what Leukemans was able to do on that kind of day, you know. So I just follow him and he bring me like perfect to a good situation and position. And then, yeah, Nibali just went too early, which was perfect. And then, yeah, he just launched me actually. Like Nibali was the best teammate of the day at the end. And
wow, okay.
It was like, when I saw that, I said, this is perfect because Nibali is one of the best riders to do that also, you know. Yeah. So when I look back, I already had a gap on the rest and then I went clear. And then, you know, it was like only like 2Ks to go and I knew with the gap I had, they will not come back, you know. So it was tailwind going over 60K an hour. I knew that no one was able to ride 70. So, yeah. It was a really nice win.
So I guess, although obviously you had great legs, it's the pain, but when you know you're in a position to win, the pain kind of disappears, doesn't it? And it's just, so you could, for those couple of minutes, it would have been just 2 minutes riding at 60K an hour for a couple of Ks over the top, that gradual downhill, then it flattens. You could really savor the moment and that realization with all the Belgian flags, I remember.
I
bet that was something really sweet. Something. Do you often go back over that at all? I guess in your retirement you will, but I bet it was just amazing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. Every time I go back to Belgium, I go there because it's really close to my house, you know? So
yeah.
It's also like a big chance to become a world champion next to your place, you know?
Of course, yeah, yeah. Like,
I'm really good friend with Torishoft, you know, and he's been world champion in Australia. And I'm not sure that he will even go back one day there, you know. So,
yeah.
And I go like maybe 10 times a year back on the circuit. And I even will organize now my last ride ever on this city, you know, Valkenburg. So this is this means so much for me, and it's so much important that I could go back to the finish line and have these memories. When I go with my friends, you know, we still sprint and do like it was the same day. And I'm sure when I will be 60, we will still do the same, you know. So
of course you will. Of course you will. And yeah, whatever kit you wear, you know, where you finish your pro, you'll have the stripes on your arm as well, you know. So just a little look down and remember them, you know. It's exactly. That's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. And as you say, people can share in that final ride, cross the line, because the finishing line is the same, I believe, or near to where the actual finish line is as well, isn't it? So
which is on the same spot. Yeah,
fantastic. Now, just turning to the monuments briefly before we wrap this up. You've won like Lombardy twice, you've won Liège, Bastogne, Liège. And then when you went back to Patrick Lefebvre's team, you had an amazing couple of years, really late in your career. And you won Flanders with that amazing solo break. And not importantly, but you were also the Belgian road champion. So just describe a little bit about what that was like, because you touched upon it a little bit when you look at the big memories from your career, because you stopped on the finish line, didn't you? Lifted your bike up because you had so much time. But that was astonishing, because I was commentating on it and I thought, flipping it, you know, Philippe Gilbert has gone really long here. But was that a risk, or did you think, I'm just going to try this? Just explain the rationale, the thinking behind going so long in such an epic race.
Yeah, actually it was like we started there with the best team ever, I think, and the strongest. And of course we had Tom Bonen on the start, so the big, big star. I think like Van Aert is not even 10%. Of the popularity of Tom was back then.
Yeah.
You know, so Tom was really the king of Belgium, you know, back then. And having Tom next to me was something special, you know, knowing it was his last Flanders. It was a lot of expectation, a lot of speculation in the media.
Sure. And
it was really big to leave this, and we were rooming together, so we spoke a lot about it. And it was the first time they put the mirror of Gerardsbergen back in the race on a 100Ks to go. So it's not the final, but you're not far from the final, you know?
Sure.
So we say, okay, guys, with the team we have to use this. It's a chance. We get the chance and we have to use it. Yeah. So it was clear. The tactic of the day was like, okay, we control a few teams we don't want in the break. And then we go full on the mirror and then we make the selection there. And this is what we did, you know. Tom and me, we looked to each other halfway the mur, and then we say, okay, we go full. And yeah, Tom start first, and then he went full to the top. And on top, we went like with 12 guys, 13 guys, and we had Trentin, Bonen, and me from Quickstep. So it was like 3 out of 12, like big operation, you know. And we knew that Stiba, Terpstra, and all the guys were blocked behind. So yeah, we just went full. And the problem was, because we were like three really good riders and from the same team, the other ones didn't want to pull, you know.
Of course.
So
yeah.
Then I said, Luke Rowe was also part of the group, and I said, mate, when we go back on the Quarmont, we have no choice. We had to make a selection, because if we just sit here with this situation, having only 5 guys turning out of 12, we will not go anywhere, you know. So we have to go harder. And we went quite full on the from the bottom, and then, you know, like halfway of the group dropped straight away. And then Trentin was going, and then I said, it's not fast enough. So I went even faster, and then I went too fast and was alone. And I said, okay, I go my pace to the top and we see after. And they never came back, you know. So it was, I was hesitating a long time, because I knew it was like over 50K to the finish.
Yeah.
But I said, I go safe and we see. So I went like, I had control of my effort, and then I said, I go like this, we see 10Ks, 15Ks, and if no one come back, then I go full. And I went full from the Koppenberg, actually, from the halfway to Koppenberg, I went full to the finish. But still, it was like, I don't know, 25, 30Ks to go. And yeah, it was the only way to win, you know, because if I went full from the beginning, I would not be able to make it.
Sure. Sure, I see. But that, I mean, that, again, just must have been an absolutely beautiful moment for you. And this was, you know, quite late in your career. So,
I remember the support of the fans, you know, because, I had the Belgium colors on my shoulders. And, yeah, you know, like you said in the beginning of the podcast, I'm from Wallonia, but I think even more supporters in Flanders, you know, because, you know, I learned everything there. I speak their language, you know, so I have a lot of fans there in Flanders, and they were really pushing me to go for the win. And it was like really, really big emotions that day. Yeah,
that's crazy. I mean, and then moving on finally to your last monument win in Roubaix 2 years later. Put it this way. Once you'd won Flanders and clearly everybody knew about your versatility, but there's not many riders that win, you know, Flanders and also Liège and Lombardy. This is, you're entering in, as you well know, a very, very rarefied atmosphere. We're looking at just like riders like Merckx. But were you thinking then, okay, Roubaix, or at what point did Roubaix come into focus, and when did you think you could win that?
I think I always knew that I had a chance, because I was, even early in my career, I was good with winning, you know, at Volk. I did also a podium in Flanders without really going 100%, you know, because I was always preparing the Ardennes. But still, on the way, I was going to Flanders with just a try, you know, but not 100%. Yeah. And I knew, okay, if I go there, I was like 90%, I was still third or close to the win. I said, then the day I will go really focus on that races, I will win them, you know. So, and Roubaix, I didn't want to try because, you know, the risk of crash is really high.
Yeah.
And yeah, when, you know, you can crash in every races, but when you crash on the cobbles, you know, you can have big damage, you know. So,
of course, yeah.
I said, I have so many other races to win before that one that I first want to give the chance to all the other races and then go only for Roubaix. So this was in my head from the beginning of my career.
Wow.
And then I said, now it's time to go for Roubaix, because even if I go and I break my leg and it's over, yeah, I will have win all the others, you know? So I went, but I went like really professional. I did a lot of recon, a lot of testing of material. You know, I invest a lot in this race.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I came that day, the first try in 18 was, I was like 15. I did the mistake of not drinking. It was a hot edition. And, you know, I finished 15 with a lot of mistakes. So I said, next year I'll go back, but it's for the win. So this make me stronger and gave me confidence, you know. So then I went for 19, the edition of 19, and there in my head I knew this is now or never, you know. So yeah, we had also a really strong team, and I knew that I had to use the team, you know. So
yeah,
I used the team really good. I played the tactic perfect, and yeah, I was able to also beat Polit, because it's a big client to beat in a sprint. So yeah, I think I did almost a perfect race that day. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I guess winning Paris-Roubaix, it has to be perfect, doesn't it? Because everything has to go right. Because as you just described, it is the race where you need luck. You obviously need, everything needs to line up. You need to have the best tactical game, the best equipment, luck, that the punches. It's rare, isn't it? But everything lined up. And then obviously you need to be so strong to even think about winning it as well, you know?
I don't think that, like, when I see the riders having crash or flat tires, this means that they are not ready or they made mistake. You know, when you're really preparing good, you know, like Bonen, I don't think he had many flat tires in Roubaix.
Right.
I also didn't have one. I think when you're good and ready, you don't have, you don't crash, you don't have flat tires, you, because you're ready. You see all the obstacles, you see all the danger, and you just avoid them. You know,
yeah.
It's like, I think it's like a rally driver. You know, he also have a lot of danger, but he doesn't make mistakes when he's good. You know,
sure.
So when you're ready, you go perfect and you don't make mistakes.
Wonderful. It's, holding that cobblestone. I mean, again, you've had so many emotional parts of your career, but you know, what were you, 30, 38, you know, well into the autumn of your career, 37, that must have been an immense moment. What was, just describe the feeling, you know, the hug of Patrick and then getting onto the podium and then holding that cobble in the air. I mean, what was that like?
Finishing on the velodrome first, it's really special. You know, we only do this in one time in the year, you know, so it's, we have no experience with that. So it's already special. You see everyone. I knew my wife was there. I knew my parents were there. I knew a lot of my fans were there. So this was also important for me. You know, I was not alone. And when you've stopped, you know, everyone comes on you, and yeah, it's just like crazy. Really crazy final. And then this podium also, you know, you had with the flames, then the trophies coming up. It's so nice. And then this heavy cobblestone, it's like 12 kilo.
Yeah. I mean, especially after Roubaix, you're going to be tired. Lifting it above your head is quite.
Yeah. Then you think, I should keep my helmet on, you know.
Oh, mate. That's nice. So, okay, my final question is, where is the cobble now?
It's in Belgium, because I still have a small house in Belgium, and I have almost all my trophies there, because, you know, usually when you win a race, it's go back to the service course. And for me, service course is already being in Belgium. And then I try to have someone to go pick it up, or that staff of the team bring it to my house, and then I collect them there.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully one day, Philippe, I'd love to come and go for a ride with you at some point, look at some of your trophies. But you've been so, so generous with your time today. I wish we could go on for another several hours, because you speak so eloquently about, there's so much detail, and when you talk about the races, I'm almost there with you, and I'm sure that everybody that listened to this podcast,
this is the patient.
Exactly. And again, just thanks again. It's been a wonderful experience. And I do urge people, if they can, to head over to your ride and share in your final ride as a professional, because I think it's going to be a wonderful day. And thanks again. Thank you very much again, Phil.
Thank you very much.
What a champion. It's not just the win, but the manner of the victory that counts. You heard it here, folks. I think that sums up Philippe's career wonderfully. What a top gent he is too. This podcast is supported by Hot Chili. What's Hot Chili, I hear you ask? Good question. So let's ask the internet.
Hot Chili organises a variety of road and gravel cycling events in the UK and internationally, catering for riders of all abilities. Hot Chili has the cycling community at the heart of everything they do, and have a dedicated app for members to connect with each other.
Wow, sounds great. But of course, I did already know that. Visit hotchili.com or download the Hot Chili app and join the friendliest, funnest cycling community on the planet. Hot Chili is spelled HOTCHILLEE and .com is spelled full stop COM. Thanks to Perry App Gwyneth for the podcast theme tune, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to like, follow and rate the pod, and maybe give it a little review if you feel like it. And why not recommend it to a pre-war scoundrel raiding the wine reserves of a Belgian city's underground caves, if you have a time machine? If you want to get in touch with the podcast, please do. Our email address is podcast@sigmasports.com. Or you can leave a message or a voice note on our WhatsApp burner phone, which is +44 777 832 3268. And finally, a massive thanks again to Philippe for joining us on the podcast today, and we wish him all the best in his well-earned retirement. Cheers all, stay safe, and adieu.